Hello and welcome to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always joined by Randeep Janda. We call the Canuck games here on the radio and we do this show every week as well. And Randeep, the Canucks came off a successful 4-1-1 road trip and had an eventful first game back inside Rogers Arena, a come-from-behind win, their ninth comeback victory of the season, beating the Columbus Blue Jackets 5-2 after going down 2-0 in the first period on Friday night. And there was a lot of good in the second part of this game, but really one of the big talking points coming out of it, in spite of the fact that the Canucks were able to pick up the win, was their poor start and how they got behind the eight ball in that first period.
Yeah, it was a very tricky first period, and you know, a lot of rust on the team. They weren't skating as the Columbus Blue Jackets were. The effort wasn't quite there. The middle of the ice was wide open for Columbus, and to be down 2-0 after the first period, consider them lucky. It could have been 3 or 4, depending on, you know, Kevin Lankinen, and if he's not there to make those saves, or if he's not playing in his A game, we could have been talking about a bigger deficit after the first 20 minutes. But, you know, credit to Vancouver. They get that goal through Brock Besser from the right faceoff circle. And then they took advantage of the mistakes that Columbus made. And most notably, Elvis Merzlikens, who on that 2-2 goal by Kiefer Sherwood, for whatever reason, wanted to go on an adventure. And we know what happens when goaltenders usually do that. It ends up going into the back of their own net. And an excellent job by Teddy Bluger to close, add pressure. And after that, it felt like Columbus was less confident. Maybe they're starting to get tired. And Vancouver upped their intensity in the third period. So not a Picasso, not quite, you know, a kid's finger painting either, right? This was something in between where the Vancouver Canucks are happy to get the 2 points, but you know they were not happy with their total game. And that's a building point for the rest of the 5 games that are coming up here, Batch, at home. They're not going to be easy. You got Tampa Bay. You got St. Louis that recently hired Jim Montgomery. You got the Cup champions in Florida, Boston, and Colorado. So it's going to be maybe a warning sign for Vancouver to up their game as those teams head into the city.
And this is something that they're well aware of, too. So it's not like they're under any sort of illusions here about how poorly they've been starting games, especially on home ice. So we'll see how that goes going forward throughout the homestand. We do want to highlight a couple of guys who had good nights, though. Jake DeBrus scores again, so he finally gets his first goal inside Rogers Arena, and the power play continues to click now, 4 straight games that they've scored goals as well.
And on Jake DeBrusk, it's not like he's doing that goal against Detroit was, you know, off the rush in overtime, off the post and in. But all his other goals, 9 of his 12 goals are coming in from the slot. They're just outside the blue paint. And post game, we had an opportunity to chat with him on the post game show. And he said, hey, I know where I'm scoring my goals. I know where I've scored my goals in my career. And they're usually off the rush or they're in that area. And he seems very confident. Getting that goal at home obviously was important to him. When you scored all 11 your goals on the road and none at home, it weighs on you a little bit. But a very confident Jake DeBrusk, one that is now also feeling very comfortable playing next to Elias Pettersson, which is exactly what he was signed for. It took a while, but this is a player that's really ramping it up. And remember, he's on in his career high in goals is 27. He's up in that right now. He's on a pretty, you know, near 40 goal pace right now, which is exactly what you want if you're Patrick Elvin.
And another guy I want to highlight too is Pugh Suter, who scored 2 goals in the win. One of them stood up as the game winning goal that gave the Canucks the 3-2 lead early in the third period. And then he adds an empty netter as well. Suter's up to 11 goals on the year. His career high in a season is 15. And he's got 11 in 25, and both he and Rick Tocchet talked after the game about how he's worked on his shot, and that's really paying dividends for him. He's quietly been one of the Canucks' better offensive producers and probably the front runner for unsung hero as of right now, although everyone in Vancouver is sung. We talk about this all the time, but man, another great performance from Pugh Suter, who also has had to elevate his game and provide a top six center ice option with the absence of JT Miller from the lineup.
He has, and I think the goal scoring, you documented it well there, where he's, you know, on pace to smash his career high. But two other areas that I think he's been really good at is, one, the PK. He's the number one, part of the number one duo, forward duo, with Teddy Bluger. They hit the ice first. And the other aspect is faceoffs batch. This is an area that hasn't been his strongest in his career, but the last two games, he's in the high 50% range, 59% against Columbus yet again. He's had to take more meaningful faceoffs now that JT Miller's out of the lineup. And even though his season average is slowly climbing, it's still sub 50, the fact that he's getting more, you know, important faceoffs in the last number of games and he's winning the majority of those draws, that tells you that he's developing not only from an offensive perspective, but his 200-foot game is getting better. And he's always been defensively responsible, but, you know, playing in a middle six role on the wing or playing on a second line role on the wing is different from playing center and getting a lot of touches of the puck. So this is a sometimes, obviously, it's terrible that you lose players to injury and you lose them to a leave of absence like JT Miller currently, but you also see players grow in that absence. And I think Pugh Suter is a great example of that.
Yeah, and you know the fact that we always joke, and the guys were joking on the post-game show last night, his nickname should be the Swiss Army Knife because he's Swiss, and you have to provide that caveat every time that you say it. But he really is, right? Like, you know, once they get these guys back, they could keep him in the middle and move him down the lineup. They could move him to the wing where he's been successful on a line with Miller and Besser at times. You know, he could even play more of a depth wing role if that's what they need for him. This guy can go anywhere in the lineup, and he still finds a way to contribute. And, you know, this year he's finding a way to produce no matter where he's playing too.
Well, and also, like, when you talk about adding depth to the wings, there was, and what do we ask players that were already on this team? How are you going to elevate your game? How are you going to, you know, differentiate yourself to the coaching staff to stay in really good positions and get elevated positions in the lineup? It's adding wrinkles to your game. And with Suter, he's been able to do that. So now, not only is he getting production, but as the season goes on, Batch, you want a player, if you're a coach, and you can trust the smarts of a player, you can trust that they're able to score goals, that just gives you so many options when you're filling out your roster and your lineup. So with Rick Tocchet, you know, he can put this guy anywhere, and he knows that Pugh Suter is going to play his style of game, the way that he wants to play. I think this has been a huge development for this team this season, an excellent signing going back a couple of years now for $1.6 million. Remember his cap hit, and we talk about the NHL and, you know, this guy's getting overpaid or that guy's getting overpaid. Pugh Suter, as of right now, is getting underpaid for his production, and the Canucks benefited from signing him a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and Tocchet has talked a lot as well about how good Suter's been on the penalty kill in tandem with Teddy Bluger, and they've been a big part of the success of that unit lately as well. So he's a pretty invaluable player for his head coach right now. We're going to break early here again because we want to get, as always, to the mailbag, and we've got a lot of great questions from the listeners to talk about in our second segment. But before we do that, let's look ahead to the Sunday game against the Tampa Bay Lightning, who come in for a matinee, a 1 o'clock puck drop at Rogers Arena. What do you think we should expect in this one? And what do the Canucks have to be prepared for against a Tampa Bay team that has a lot of winners and a lot of proven veterans on their roster?
Well, you got to be ready for minute one of that game because Tampa Bay, you know, they are fighting right now in that pretty difficult Atlantic division. Toronto and Florida are currently at the top of that division. Boston and Tampa are kind of going head to head with a few games in hand for the Tampa Bay Lightning, but that's not an easy division. They are playing well. They've got a goal differential of plus 20 right now. And when you have players like Hedman, Braden Point, Kucherov, of course, you have to make sure that if you have breakdowns in that game, it's going to cost you. Like, with all due respect to Columbus, we still know that they're a team that's on the way up. They're going to maybe take some chances, but they're not going to take advantage of others. Tampa is cutthroat. They're as business-minded as they come. And two players to watch in this game, Nick Paul, Brandon Hagel. These guys are absolute menaces on the forecheck. And for Vancouver, they got to make sure that they move the puck up the ice quickly, Batch. And that's something they struggled against Columbus, or at the very least get it out of their own zone cleanly. Because Tampa Bay, with those two guys I mentioned, and Braden Point, of course, they can attack you, and they can attack you quick.
Yeah, of course, the Lightning handed the Canucks one of their few road losses back early in the season, just the third game of the year in Vancouver's first road game. They fell 4-1 at the hands of the Lightning down in Florida. But we'll talk about that game and have plenty more for you when we return on the other side and get into the mailbag here on In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always, joined by Randeep Janda. And if you've missed any part of the show listening on the radio, it lives as a podcast as well on the Canucks Central podcast feed. You get In the Booth every week. You get every Canucks postgame show with Sat and Bick. And you get the daily show Monday to Friday, Canucks Central, with Sat and Reach as well. All right, Randeep, as is tradition, let's open up the mailbag here in the second segment of the show. We've got a lot of great questions from our listeners, as we always do. And let's start out with one from @Gerbs on Twitter, who writes in and asks, when JT Miller returns, does he slot right back into his spot on the first power play unit? And this is a really interesting question. First of all, I think the answer is absolutely yes, Randeep. He does, because he's one of your best forwards. He was a 100-point guy. You're going to give him that opportunity on the first unit. But I understand the question based on the fact that the first power play unit has scored a goal in four straight games, and it's been a big part of their success of late as well.
Yeah, and with this power play, I think one of the areas it's really improved is it's added some element of surprise to this power play, where previously, what did we talk about? We talked about, you know, being mechanical, being static. And when JT Miller is on that power play, when he is the quarterback, the puck always goes to him. Where here, now they've had to play a little bit more, you know, less reliant on one single player. They've added wrinkles to their game. And Batch, if we go back through the last seven games, their power play is at 31.8%. So I'm with you. JT Miller will be on that power play, but they have to act as they are now. There's more point shots from Quinn Hughes coming in. There's more, you know, creativity down low. There's more, working it down low and getting shots through and attacking the blue paint in the in front of the net. That's what they have to stick to, even when JT Miller's back. So I'm not saying JT has to change his game, but the Canucks players in the past are always getting the puck to him and saying, all right, you're going to lead the play. You're going to start off the sequence. And there is an element of, okay, now all five players can create, or there's two or three passing options. And I think they have to bottle it up. So I agree. JT has to be on the power play. He's your, you know, high scoring player last year. He's a 100-point guy. He is NHL. He was fourth in the league last year in primary assists. But they have to bottle some of this up too, because this is kind of that road hockey style that Rick Tocchet was mentioning in the playoffs last year and all throughout the preseason.
Yeah, and as you allude to, rightfully so, so much of this power play usually goes through JT Miller, and the fact that he hasn't been there has forced some other guys to handle the puck and get involved, and I think that's part of why the power play is having success. We're seeing Elias Pettersson with the puck on his stick more often, and although at times he's tentative or double clutches with his decisions, I think he's been better in that regard of making plays and trying to create. Obviously, Jake DeBrusk around the front of the net, has been tremendous. And I think that's going to be an interesting conversation. The more interesting part of this for me is not does JT go back onto PP1, but who comes off PP1 to make way for JT, because Jake DeBrusk wasn't on that unit prior to Miller's departure from the lineup on personal leave. But the way DeBrusk is scoring lately, and especially around the front of the net, and a lot of those goals are coming on the power play, I don't think you can take him off that first unit right now.
No, I think Connor Garland's going to have to be that player based on the fact that this is exactly what you want from DeBrusk. Now, what's changed is DeBrusk is, rather than the bumper spot, which we saw at the beginning of the year, we've seen him obviously take the net front. He's been more attack-centered in that area, and that's something that's working out very well for the Canucks. So I think, yeah, JT coming back in probably means Connor Garland goes to power play two. And let's be honest, power play two has not been the same since Connor Garland left it, so that might be a better spot for him. Not ideal for Connor Garland and his picking up of points and his involvement on the power play. But if you're looking to add a little bit more balance, that's probably where number eight on the Canucks goes once JT's back.
And then you move Besser up into the bumper spot, correct, and Miller takes his spot on the left half wall. Pettersson stays on the right half wall. Hughes goes at the point, as he always does. I think that's probably the best way to carry forward with that unit, because we know Besser's capable of using his shot from that spot in the bumper as well. So that'll be interesting to see. And again, as of right now, we don't know when JT Miller's going to return. All that Rick Tocchet has said is that he's been skating on his own and that they have a plan in terms of getting him back to practice and getting him back with the team. So that'll be coming, I would imagine, in the next couple of weeks. But at the same time, the hockey club has made it pretty clear that they don't want firm timelines put on this with Miller's personal leave. So we will wait and see if we're talking about JT Miller being back in the lineup when we do this show this time next week. Next question comes in on Twitter from Dalvir, who writes in and says, even given the win, talking about the last game, the comeback victory over the Blue Jackets, what is with the Canucks' performances at home this season? Several stinkers already. Did the crowd at Rogers Arena during the playoffs have some sort of long-lasting effect on them? Are we too loud? Do we need to be louder? And he says, thanks, lads. I don't think this has anything to do with the crowd. I think this is entirely a mental thing on the part of the players that they'll need to work through here, because they have had some bad performances on home ice. And, you know, even though they came back to beat Columbus, there were a lot of things that, you know, could be improved from the way they played. And certainly that first period, and that's where I think I want to start, is the beginnings of games at home have not been good enough. And there's been a sprinkling of that on the road too, but to me, this is more about mindset, mentality, and preparation in terms of being ready at the drop of the puck in your own barn.
Well, if Dalvir asked that question to a Canucks player or to the team, they'd probably answer saying, hey, it's not you, it's me, based on the fact that the team hasn't been able to, you know, deliver on home ice. And the starts are very key. And even going back to that Columbus game, you know, the opening 20 minutes for sure. And I understand coming back from a long road trip, getting your legs back, getting back to speed to a certain extent is a challenge. It's not the first time that's happened, but there is a bit of a theme here. In the start of the game, Batch, they're usually the second team to score in a game. They're usually playing catch-up. They've had 9 comeback wins this season. So it's not that the Vancouver Canucks are, you know, I think they might be at this point, even though the team is saying otherwise, they might be overthinking a little bit here, right? Where sometimes you start to squeeze the stick. There's a couple of things. I think that's an element of it. The other thing is effort, right? A Columbus team comes in last game and they brought the effort. They're skating, just getting started on home ice. Sometimes until you're actually pushed against the wall, that's when you kind of react and that's when you get into the game. I feel like this team on home ice, for whatever reason, and this is for the team to figure out, the coaches to figure out, I don't know if they take it for granted or if they're kind of sitting back a little bit, but until they're pushed against the wall, they don't react. In some games, that works because you're playing a team that might not be a playoff team or is not an elite team. In other games, you play the New Jersey Devils and they slap you around a little bit. So it's a very dangerous game. You get the win. You're 4-5-3 at home now. You got some good vibes. Jake DeBrus finally scores at home. But no doubt, this is something that they have to sort out, especially going into a game against the Tampa Bay Lightning, which is a team that's battling in the Atlantic, and other teams that will be coming to Vancouver to play on home ice. You can't fall behind in games like that, especially against good teams. It's not a good habit.
No, and, you know, this is a team that has made part of its identity under Rick Tocchet an ability to be resilient and come back in games, and we've seen that from them. But we talked about this, I think, a few weeks ago on the show. Eventually, that luck runs out. Like, that's not sustainable, and we saw that exact thing happened in Game 7 against the Oilers, where they spotted Edmonton a lead, and then they had that furious comeback in the third period, but ultimately, they ran out of time against a really good club and weren't able to tie that game and ultimately lost the series as a result. So, you know, I think the poor starts in particular in the first period are different this year than what we saw from this team last year, because if I'm not mistaken off the top of my head, I think they scored the first goal more times than any other team in the league last year. So that part has changed. The fact that you can be resilient when things go the wrong direction for you is important, But with that said, at the same time, you need to be leading earlier first, or you at least need to be playing better earlier in these games to give yourself a chance so that you're not playing chase and you're not playing catch up all night long, every night, especially in your own building.
Well, there's two types of resiliency, right? There's one that this team is going through right now. They've had some injured players. They've had some absences. They've had, you know, sometimes a road trip, a long road trip can be winning and playing well and fighting through that can provide resiliency. This type of resiliency, when you're falling behind, and it's really, in a way, it's procrastination. You're being resilient because you're fighting through it, but Batch, it's self-inflicted, right? So there are different types of resiliency. To me, this one is you're putting yourself in that situation. It's not like the circumstances have put you in that. So that's a dangerous game. I'm with you. I think you want to have a little bit of resiliency, no doubt, to have the ability to say we can come back in games. But if that becomes a part of your identity, that's a tricky, tricky thing as well. And you don't want to build that habit because later on in the year, yeah, the good teams, when you get into March, April, when they lock down and if you fall behind, it's tougher to get back into those games. A one-goal lead in March is very different from a one-goal lead in January or December. So I think that habit of getting ahead, having that one or two-goal lead yourself, something that this team was very good at last year, they got to get back to that.
Next question comes in from Justin in East Van, who asks, how will the Canucks manage their defense by committee while Filip Hronek is on LTIR? This is one that we could really sink our teeth into because the cracks are showing in terms of their defensive depth or lack thereof right now. And I don't want to pick on individual players, but we've seen that Vinny Desharnais has had a really tough time of it lately since coming back into the lineup on a regular basis. So I don't really know how they're going to manage it. I guess that all depends on whether they go out and acquire a defenseman to help or whether they try to get by with the guys they've got. Derek Forbert's nearing a return. He's been skating in a non-contact jersey with the team. So that could be a way to try and round out your defensive depth. Although if you were to pull Desharnais out and put Forbert in, then somebody's playing on their offside, a left shot on the right side. I do wonder if Mark Friedman's an option to get into games here sooner rather than later. Cole McWard, who was briefly called up as well. I wonder if they're seriously considering giving him a run and an opportunity at the NHL level. But until they make a move or until they bring in a defenseman to try and help things on the back end, I think what we've seen in terms of how they have managed those minutes is what they're going to have to continue to do here for the next, 7-8 weeks until Filip Hronek gets back in the lineup.
Yeah, there's been progress on the Carson Soucy front and the Tyler Myers front. I know they're playing away from each other, but at the very least, there's some stability there. With Tyler Myers, it's a little easier when Quinn Hughes is on your pair. With Carson Soucy, there's been a real development of him looking calm, him looking decisive. And even though that pairing of Juleson and Soucy hasn't had maybe the most success on the road trip, there's peaks and valleys. I think the individual game of Carson Soucy is really elevated. Now, Vincent Desharnais, as you mentioned, got nearly 19 minutes of ice time against the Columbus Blue Jackets, some of that with Quinn Hughes, but there are definitely weaknesses in his game. On the PK, he is money. He is plugging up those shooting lanes. He's, you know, on one shift in that Columbus game, he had three blocks, kind of pulling a Noah Juleson there where he was just eating pucks over and over again. But 5-on-5 Batch is where you can really see the challenge of Vincent Desharnais. He's getting caught by the physicality. I don't think he uses his size as much as you'd expect somebody that big to do so. And the first goal by Matthew Olivier was a classic example of that, where Cole Sillinger is quick to the puck, but I don't know if Desharnais does a very strong job of shielding the puck there, using his size to keep Sillinger away. It was pretty easy for Sillinger to make that play and really start a cycle there for the Columbus Blue Jackets. So one of the things I would consider, and I know we saw this against Columbus, is do you see him a little bit more with Quinn Hughes? And the reason I ask that is, do you simplify the job a little bit for Vincent Desharnais to say, all right, you're going to be playing next to the puck dominant player. We want you to play obviously physical, break the cycle, but we want you to handle the puck a little bit less. And of course, the good teams are going to dump it into his side and they're going to make him force that play. But I feel right now when he's playing away from Quinn, he's handling the puck a lot more and he's getting caught on the forecheck. Is that a way, while Filip Hronek is not in the lineup, do you try to maybe use that and experiment with that pairing a little bit. They already started against Columbus, but I'm just trying to figure out how you can maybe protect Desharnais a little bit more if he's in the lineup. Obviously, playing with Quinn is a big responsibility, but do you want to make sure that there's a puck-dominant player playing alongside him?
Yeah, and you're right. We did see that in the game against Columbus, although later in the game when they were protecting the lead, we actually saw Carson Soucy have some shifts with Quinn Hughes, even as a left shot. So I think this is a work in progress in terms of how they're going to manage it going forward to answer Justin's question. But, you know, that's the mentality they're going to need to have next man up. And I do also worry about the utilization of Quinn Hughes because he's been playing a lot and those minutes have been creeping up. And, you know, Quinn Hughes is still a tremendous player. I'm not criticizing him here at all, but I think we have maybe seen some of the fallout of that increased play in terms of him not impacting the game on quite as high a level as he was maybe earlier in the season. I know they're trying to mitigate the minutes in other ways, like he had a maintenance day when they practiced going into the Columbus game. So Rick Tocchet essentially said Hughes wanted to practice and he told him not to and kept him off the ice. So kind of trying to protect him from himself to a certain extent. But that's one thing I worry about. And you know, we've talked about this with goaltending, which we're going to come to talk about in a minute here. But, you know, managing minutes for your top players so that they don't get worn down, so that they don't get injured is important. And I think that's something they're going to have to be very careful about for the next couple of months with Quinn Hughes, because the temptation is going to be to play him 30 minutes every night because of how big a difference maker he is, but at what cost?
Yeah, one thing with Quinn Hughes as well is this year compared to last year in the regular season, of course, rather than the playoffs, because we did see Quinn Hughes get hit in the playoffs a little bit last year, whether it was Kiefer Sherwood, whether it was in the second round. This time around in the regular season batch, we're seeing players catch up a little bit to Quinn Hughes, and he's got that acceleration. But earlier this year, there was the first time in against the Islanders, he was hitting open ice, which is something I've really never seen Quinn Hughes get hit. Against Columbus, he was kind of mauled in the neutral zone. So teams are playing him much more physical even in the regular season. They understand that if you're going to get this guy, you got to lay the body on him. So it's not only the minutes that he's playing. We're seeing teams step up against him a little bit more, and that does take a toll, right? You're playing near 30 minutes, and there's going to be aches and pains in an 82-game schedule. And that maintenance day, of course, he's had them this season. But I'm sure, like any player, there's always going to be a little bit of aches and pains going on. So no doubt, I think from the time on ice, but also teams playing him just a little bit more physical will have a toll on him. So you got to make sure you manage those minutes.
Well, and beyond just Quinn Hughes, I think with a patchwork blue line at the moment, let's call it that, with a guy like Hronek missing, and again, we'll see how they sort of manage these defensemen going forward, but I think the way Columbus played in the first period is kind of a roadmap for teams about how to have success against the Canucks, because it was the second of a back-to-back for the Blue Jackets, so they weren't able to sustain this over the 60 minutes, but in that 20 minutes, we were talking about it on the broadcast, how relentlessly they were forechecking, how quickly their forwards were getting in and getting on top of the Vancouver D, and that takes a physical toll. It takes a toll in terms of the energy you have to expend when you're always going back for pucks and taking hits. And, you know, that doesn't just apply to Hughes. That applies to this whole back end. You know, you were talking about Desharnais managing the puck and handling the puck in those sorts of situations. So that's what they need to be aware of. And I think they got better at it as the game went on. And part of that was because Columbus really couldn't sustain that relentless forecheck throughout 60 minutes. But in order to help these defensemen get through this stretch, there's an onus on Vancouver's forwards there too to try and get in front of those guys getting in on the forecheck and slow them up a little bit, and you know, maybe a little bit of accidentally on purpose interference to give your guys more time to manage the puck and move it up the ice. And that applies to Quinn Hughes, but it applies to everyone on that blue line as well.
Yeah, it was very easy for Columbus to enter that attacking zone for Vancouver, the offensive defensive zone of Vancouver. It was quite easy, and I do want to give a shout-out because I know Columbus ends up losing that game, but two players that caught my eye Adam Fantilli and the local kid Kent Johnson. There's real development in both of those games. They were tough to handle with speed through the neutral zone, and it's the two-way game, especially of Kent Johnson. Remember, he was there's rumors that he might be traded, or you know, he was being sent to the AHL. Maybe there was some displeasure at his usage, but that kid has really developed. So even though they lost that game, yeah, the way that they're playing with speed through the neutral zone, being aggressive on the forecheck, they certainly pose some problems. And yeah, Vancouver doesn't, I think, slow down that speed in the neutral zone. Early in that game, they looked like they were playing at two speeds. Columbus was playing fast and Vancouver was kind of average. Plugging up that neutral zone a little bit, getting in the way, which is something that Tocchet mentioned a lot last year, hasn't so much this year. I think they have to get back to that.
Our next question will address the goaltending, and it comes from Woodrow, the eligible bachelor, who writes in and asks, what are the expectations for Thatcher Demko now that he has returned to the lineup? And we're going to have to follow this and see what happens in the next few days. As of the time of recording, we do not know officially who is going to start on Sunday afternoon against Tampa. But I think the one thing we can say is Thatcher Demko is going to be back in the crease soon. The fact that he was able to dress against Columbus is a really good sign. It means essentially that he's good to go and would have been able to play if something had happened to Kevin Lankinen in that game. So we'll see Demko in the crease in the very near future. If not Sunday, then probably sometime in the coming week. In terms of expectations, I think it's probably reasonable to temper them early. And I think the really interesting thing to follow here, Randeep, is how they manage the minutes in the crease and, you know, whether they give Demko a good run of games here or whether he plays a game and then gets a few days off and Lankinen goes in for the next one. And that's a great luxury they have because of how well Kevin Lankinen has played. And, you know, we can talk about his game specifically against Columbus, where he really held the minute in the first period where they were outshot 17-2. And Demko even talked about that when he met with the media this week, that he doesn't feel as much pressure on his shoulders because of how well Lankinen has played. So, you know, I'm really curious to see what Thatcher Demko looks like when he gets in the crease. But if there are some growing pains and if it's slow early on and if it takes some time, that's okay because this team has time in the crease because Kevin Lankinen has bought them that time.
And, you know, to specifically to Woodrow's question, what are the expectations? We're going to see after game one. Honestly, I think when Thatcher Demko plays that first game, how he feels, how he's able to work on that knee is going to set the expectations. So you start looking at the schedule for Vancouver. They've got Tampa on Sunday. And then after that, they're playing every other day. So there's no back-to-backs until the 18th and 19th, where they play Utah in Utah and then Vegas. So that's really the part of the schedule that you have to say, all right, we know he's going to have to play one of those games. In the lead-up to that, if they wanted, Kevin Lankinen could start all five of those games if they wanted. Of course, there's going to be wear and tear. There's going to be fatigue. So you probably don't want your number one goaltender as of this moment to play all of them. But they do have some flexibility. The question is, and I think, you know, Thatcher was very honest in his availability saying, yeah, I'm not sure what to expect. Well, once you play that first game, you kind of take it from there. So the expectations, Thatcher Demko of old, it's going to be, remember, he hasn't played in 200 plus days, right? This is a player that hasn't had game action. So expect to see that Thatcher Demko, I think, is going to be very unfair. The fact that he'll be on the ice, the fact that he's able to compete at that level is a starting point. And then after that, can he give you backup duty? As of right now, that's my expectation of, can he give you, you know, league average type of goaltending in the short to medium term here? Because, Batch, as much as we want to focus on him being back, this is really meaningful for February, March, April. Can you have a Thatcher Demko that is near his usual self around that time? That's the most important thing. So I think the expectation for me is, can he play a backup level for the next month, maybe month and a half, and then we reassess?
Yeah, and I think another expectation is that they'll essentially operate as a tandem, that it's not going to be Demko going in and getting the workload again. We've got some interesting non-hockey questions that we can get to now. Let's start with Brian, regular listener who writes in and says, okay, Batch and Randeep, here's the situation. You and your families are at Christmas dinner with the Canucks. You're at the dinner table. Who do you ask to pass you the salt, Petey or Quinn? And I think we should have free reign to pick other players in this conversation too, but I don't know, for me, Quinn Hughes is the best passer on the team, so if I need someone to dish me the salt from across the table, I'm probably leaning on the captain.
Okay, so I have a question. Where am I seated? Because if it's a seam pass through bodies, I'm probably going to go Petey on this.
Yeah.
If there's actual other items on the table, and he's got to make a diagonal pass, and it's got to be crisp, and it's got to have some zip to it. If I'm sitting across the table and there's dishes there and all that, I'm probably going Petey on this one.
Yeah, that's a fair call. So I'll go with Quinn, you'll go with Petey, and we'll see who's better at dishing the salt if we ever sit down for a Christmas dinner with those guys.
If you're at the top of the table, like Quinn is, if Quinn's passing it to the right-hand side or the left-hand side, I get that. But if I'm looking for that one tee with the salt there, Batch, I'm looking at it from maybe from Petey cross ice.
Yeah, there you go. Next question in from JD, and he has a goofy question and then a serious one. So let's do the goofy question first. He calls it a lighthearted question.
All right.
Which one of us, you and me, are either the Griswolds or Cousin Ed in the Vacation movie? And I assume he's referring specifically to Christmas Vacation.
Yes, and this is my favorite Christmas movie of all time. I love it. I watch it every year. Are you a Christmas Vacation guy?
Not a huge one. I think I've seen it once or twice, but it's not
really
like a huge tradition for me. But I have a lot of friends that love it, so maybe I need to give it another watch and get back into it.
And also, now that you have kids, you might see it differently because you might see yourself in the Griswold family. You never know. To answer the question, first, like I said, my favorite movie when it comes to Christmas time, I'm more like the Griswolds. Cousin Eddie is wild. I think everybody's got a Cousin Eddie in their family that just shows up unannounced, is the life of the party in the wrong way. I play it more low-key. I like to kind of host. I like to invite people over, do that with the fam, but not take it over like Cousin Eddie and having, sewage coming out of his RV in the front yard and have his family take over. No, I'm a little bit more low-key, but I do definitely have my comical moments. So I'm going to go with the Griswolds on this one.
Yeah, I would have to say the same for me as well. And then JD with a hockey question here. With Hoglander, does Tocchet have trust with him, or will they move him on? And we've seen Hoglander's deployment increase a little bit in recent games, but I wouldn't necessarily say there's trust there. And I think it's an open question right now as to whether they will move him on or not. I think that's probably going to depend on the specifics of a deal that comes up and the value that they might be able to get for Hoglander, or whether he's included in a package for a big piece that they need, like a defenseman or something like that. But everything we hear out of the organization is that they are committed to making things work with Nils Hoglander, but it's clear that Nils Hoglander needs to pick up his end of that bargain and start playing more to the style and the way that Rick Tocchet needs him to.
Well, there's, 14, 15 games now without a point, which is something that hurts you if you're Nils Hoglander. You need to get back on the score sheet. But the trust factor is important here, and I think there is belief and trust in the organization to get the best out of this player. But, Batch, you mentioned a couple of things. If you're looking to improve this team, which we expect Patrick Alvin will want to at some point, and most probably the back end, what assets do you have that you want to deal or you can deal? We look through the organization. They're very high on Tom Melander. They're high on Lekker Mäki. You have draft picks, and, of course, you want to hold on to a couple of those. You don't want to deal them every single year. So when you start going down, the pecking order in the organization, I understand Lekker Mäki and Villander are different types of prospects and they're different types of assets. And so is a first round draft pick. But at some point you have to deal something that may provide value to other teams. And right now, Nils Hoglander, we've heard the discussion around him in the NHL of, Columbus may be interested, or Pittsburgh is, interested, and Washington's name has been thrown out there and a few others. The reason is he's on a cheap contract now, and, this is a player that some scouting staffs certainly believe in, and his number going forward at $3 million is still very manageable, where with the cap going up, it makes a lot of sense to teams. So at some point, the Canucks are going to have to make a deal if they want to acquire a defenseman or add some other depth throughout the organization, and you have to give something to get something. I think Nils Höglander, based on the way that teams are interested in him, his name will pop up a lot more, and the fact that you have to give something up that isn't a Tom Vilander or a Lekkerimäki. Like, Nils Höglander, I feel, will be very prominent in these discussions. So to answer the question, yeah, like, if I had to make a bet, I feel like his name will be out there, and if you're trying to add depth to the organization, I feel like Nils Höglander is probably a part of that deal.
And we've heard his name in trade reports and rumors already. So, you know, his name is out there, but whether that's the Canucks putting it out there or whether that's teams calling on him or asking for him in return in potential deals, we obviously aren't in the room. We don't know exactly, but, you know, there have been lots of players that we can look back at who have trended in the direction that Nils Höglander has trended in, and none of those guys are still with the organization. Recent memory, I think about Andrei Kuzmenko, Daniel Sprong. These are players that had offensive upside but didn't play the game the way that Rick Tocchet needed them to, and as a result are no longer here. Time for a few more questions here. At Canucklehead24 writes in and asks, is Juan Soto coming to the Canucks? I think, Randeep, we can confidently say that Juan Soto is not coming to the Canucks, but I know your team and my team are still in the sweepstakes for him right now. You're a Yankee fan. I'm a Red Sox fan. So it's amazing that we're able to coexist as well as we do. But no, Juan Soto's not coming to Vancouver, I don't think, at least not to play baseball.
Well, I was going to say, Ethan, who sent in this question, can he play the right side of defense? Can he skate? Because if he can play the right side of defense, there might be an option. But apparently the Yankees are lowballing him at a measly $550 million, whereas the Red Sox have stepped up to the plate, $600 million. And the Blue Jays, yes, the parent company of our station, the Blue Jays, of course, owned by Rogers as well, apparently they might have the most spending power out of all. So I know our teams are interested, but there's a lot of Blue Jays fans that listen to this station and listen to the podcast. And so it makes it interesting, Batch. It makes it really interesting. Of course, the Dodgers are involved too, which why wouldn't they be in? And the New York Mets, who are the big boys on the block now, they got the biggest checkbook.
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that situation, and maybe by this time next week, one of us will have a chance to gloat on the show about our team signing Juan Soto. We got another question in quickly from Eric, who wrote in on Blue Sky. And this is tied into the conversation we were having about the defense. And we've kind of talked about this before, but we'll answer it quickly. He says, with the loss of Hronek for the next couple of months, who is number one on the trade acquisition list for Jim and Patrick? What top four defenseman is out there that would be the best fit for the Canucks? And unfortunately, the answer to this question is that there isn't one, really. At least not one that's on the market right now or going to be available at a decent cost. I think Rasmus Anderson was the name that everybody was expecting to be moved prior to the deadline coming into the season out of Calgary, but the Flames have had a better year than people expected, although maybe they're starting to come back down to earth a little bit. So, you know, we'll see where things go between now and the deadline. But in terms of an immediate solution to cover up for the loss of Hronek, I don't know if there's an obvious defenseman that they could acquire out there, especially on the right side. And any defenseman that becomes available on the market on the right-hand side is going to cost a pretty penny as well.
For sure it is. And with the Flames, though, I think with Rasmus Anderson, this is a team that is starting to struggle a little bit. They've picked up losses in five of their last six, and their points percentage is still pretty good. Number one wild card team as of right now, based on points percentage, they'd be number two behind the Edmonton Oilers, but we're starting to see some cracks in their game. And I know in Calgary, this conversation has popped up of, all right, now that this team is starting to free fall a little bit, do you keep them or do you let them go? So that conversation is not done. That is one that I think is going to get louder. And if he is available, you have to consider Rasmus Anderson. But here's the issue, Batch. He's going to have a lot of suitors. He's really the only quality defenseman that might be, or high-end defenseman, I should say, that might be available. So the price will be steep. The other player I'm looking at, and I know he hasn't had a great stretch in Montreal, but right shot defenseman, David Savard. Is this a player that might be available for a team that is not It's a rental, strictly a rental, $3.5 million. He's a UFA at the end of the season, and very much a player that can play in your top four, either next to Quinn Hughes if you want to break up that pairing, or you can have him next to a left shot D, whether that's a Carson Soucy, a shutdown pair. I would start focusing on David Savard a little bit as well, because I think for a playoff grizzled team, David Savard, Cup champion, can provide that and could be a pretty decent asset for any team heading into the playoffs.
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that. But again, with the cost right now and the fact that teams know that the Canucks really need a defenseman, this is more like pre-deadline conversation for me than it is in the next week or two, shall we say. And now that I've said that, watch them make that trade tomorrow and bring in David Savard. Who knows? Our last question here is, we're tight on time. And you were really on it with the Christmas vacation question. This might be more my area of expertise, as Lionel Hutz writes in and asks, top three favorite Taylor Swift songs. So do you have a top three favorite Taylor Swift songs, or am I taking this one?
Batch, this is all you. I have to plead the fifth on this one. I am not a Taylor Swift guy. She's a great businesswoman, and she's taken over the world, but I am out on Taylor Swift. I got nothing on this topic. This is all you.
Okay, so I want to spread mine out across a variety of different albums. So I like State of Grace off Red. That's a really good song. I like The One off of Folklore. That's a good one, too. And I got to pick something off 1989. I'm going to go with Wildest Dreams. So those are my top three, at least at the moment. I think they change for people all the time. And an appropriate question, because Taylor Swift is in town right now, and I was surprised, Randeep. I thought the traffic getting in and out of the rink for the Friday game against Columbus was going to be a zoo. It actually wasn't that bad. Thankfully, though, the Canucks game ended early enough that we were all able to get out of there and get home before all the Swifties were coming out of BC Place across the street.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool vibe and energy in and around the rink. Obviously, even in the rink, they had, you know, Taylor Swift songs going. But since this show is called In the Booth, I want to take you behind the scenes with me and Batch. As this game was about to get going against Columbus, my broadcast partner, Brendan Batchelor, was in line to get tickets for Taylor Swift. You missed out, but I wanted to take the audience and the listenership behind the scenes that my man is not only doing prep for the show, he's trying to get tickets for the Friday night game. Unfortunately, you missed out, though, Batch.
Yeah, I'm for people that know all the hoops you have to jump through for Ticketmaster, I have been verified to be in some of these queues to get last-minute tickets this week. So I've been trying. Obviously, I wouldn't have been able to go yesterday because we were calling the game, but used those tickets and put them to a good cause, or allowed a friend to go so they could experience what, obviously, I think, you know, whether you like Taylor Swift or not, you have to recognize that this is kind of bigger than Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour. And
it's a cultural moment. Absolutely.
Exactly. So, you know, those are hot tickets regardless. So I was in those queues yesterday. I'll be in them over the weekend too, trying to see if I can snag some last minute tickets. But, you know, it's a battle to try and get those tickets, to say the least. So I expect that to happen, but
I was going to say, I might be doing the same thing on Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi, today. I might be multitasking.
Yeah, there you go. Speaking of which, we will be on the air on Sunday calling the Canucks and Lightning game, 1 o'clock face-off, a matinee. So if you're a Swiftie, you can come to the Canuck game first and then go to the concert afterwards. Our pregame show will get underway at noon. But on Saturday night, as you mentioned, Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi, what's coming up on your show, Randy?
We got Toronto-Pittsburgh in Game 1, and then St. Louis, who is coming to Vancouver very soon, against Edmonton in Game 2. So a couple of out-of-division matchups, but plenty of star power.
All right, we'll be watching for that. And again, you can join us Sunday, the Canucks and the Lightning, right here on your official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.